Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Taylor, joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Good morning.
Hello. And joined by Ash Millman.
Hello.
Now, for people who don't know Mr. Benjamin Richardson, he's our best guru man who comes up with all sorts of different content things. And his chances are he's already written something that many people already love.
Yeah, I mean, so far I've been banned from the podcast because my northern phonemes aren't really suitable for a wider audience.
Yeah, so feel free to shout at him in the comments if you can't understand what he says. And we will.
I mean,
we'll go
all right for Josh, but apparently not me.
he's sort of refined himself a little bit. So Amy Hennig, creative director on the old Uncharted games, did a bit with the Legacy of Kain games, was recently talking about the viability of single player in the industry and the idea that something like the first Uncharted wouldn't get greenlit anymore. And obviously these comments got blown up, you know, to this whole conversation around the viability of single player overall. The thing that a lot of outlets missed was that she wasn't saying that single player isn't viable at all.
Yeah.
Because obviously one of the go-to, and I retweeted this because in the moment I was like, yes!
But here he is with his retweets.
Here he is with the things. Was, you know, one of the things that blew up was like, well, look at all the single player games recently. God of War, Spidey, Uncharted, even Uncharted 4 outsold XYZ multiplayer. And that's not what she was saying. She was saying, look at the viability of a new single-player story-driven IP, because that's where it gets really weird.
Well, and I think there's something else embedded in those comments is that she was very specific about a short, and she mentioned 8 hour long, for example, single-player campaign.
Mm-hmm. And you hate the word campaign.
I do hate the word campaign, but she used it, so I'm quoting her. As how they're no longer viable. You look at the single-player games you just mentioned, Spider-Man and even Uncharted 4, and what was the one you mentioned?
Spider-Man, God of War.
That's it, yeah. And we're all much, much longer games than we would traditionally expect from a single-player game. Almost as if the content has been stretched out dramatically to appease the expectation of an audience. And I think that is precisely what she's saying. You couldn't do something like the first Uncharted, just a nice two-three-night game that's complete, well-rounded, everything has to be in and out, you know.
It's also not open world as well. Like the first, I mean, Uncharted in Uncharted 4 has this stupid term which is wide linear for those like bigger levels. Call me Johnny Wide Linear.
It's bizarre because Uncharted 4 is ostensibly a linear game.
Yes,
but I think you've got a couple of levels where you're in that off-road vehicle in
the big
Madagascar.
Safari stuff.
Almost as if those were an attempt to placate the desire to be open world without her actually having to make an open world game, which she so clearly doesn't want to do.
It's not linear, it's wide linear. Yeah. Just like, please remember the wide.
But I mean, that means you can go left as well as forward and backwards.
I mean, like, Hennig had left Uncharted at that point, but it's interesting because something like Uncharted Lost Legacy like literally has a bit where you go to this big open hub world thing, and there's a big old tower, and it's like, hey, do you want to get some collectibles? You can if you want. There's some coins, go get some stuff. And it's like, here's open world design infiltrating something that was, you know, like primarily linear. But I think the conversation is interesting because if you try to think of new single player story focused games with new characters, because she had another point about like, or the wider conversation references the idea that we're only interested in sequels and franchises, something like Uncharted 4 did so well because it's building on Uncharted. So if you try to think of new single player story focused games, I can think of Horizon, 2016's Horizon, in terms of like a whole new world. And there's other Sony ones, like they've got Days Gone coming up, but obviously it's playing on zombie tropes and it's open world again. And so like Sony have been flying the flag. Ghost of Tsushima is another one. But I don't know if you guys have anything that comes to mind? I think the whole point is that there's not too much.
No, literally, there's plenty of games that introduce new characters into a storyline we're already familiar with, but like that is literally it, isn't it? It's all building on legacies of the past, which is where all the AAA games come from now.
Well, I'd say the example would be Red Dead Redemption 2.
But yeah, but it's a sequel.
With it is, but with a new
There's another
character,
point to that too.
But then that leads you into John Marston's story, so it's not even something that is technically a new character.
There's no risk involved whatsoever when you, as you say, you introduce new characters into established IPs. In terms of a AAA sphere, absolutely none spring to mind. I know in independent games for all over the place, but nobody ever talks about them. And I'm going to mention it.
That's a great pivot because it's worth. I've done a couple of videos on this. We've talked about it amongst the office and stuff. The general sort of conversation around like indie gaming. It used to have this kind of stigma around it where it's like, oh my god, they're all pixel platformers. But whatever, not all of them, Ash.
It was stigmatized also because people were expecting to get a lesser experience from a lower budget game. It was always that independent games couldn't possibly match the quality of a AAA game. Because they didn't have the budgets, because they didn't have the development teams, and because maybe they didn't have the experience behind them. I think that's not the case anymore.
No.
I think we're seeing what are essentially indie games produced with budgets that are outstripping games of previous generations. You know,
budgets is a huge thing because something like Hellblade, that Senua's Sacrifice, I always get the name of the developer wrong. I think it's Team Ninja. It's them or some Ninja Theory, one of the two. Ninja Theory, so
there's
I'm going to go with. I'll put my bets on Ninja Theory. They wanted to prove that you could do something that looked like a AAA game with an indie soul. Like it's entirely story focused, not open world, it's really linear. And they wanted to prove that if you just keep an eye on the budget, not everything has to be massive gargantuan, Anthem size, 4K Leafs and all that.
The problem is that the definition of a AAA game has been completely redefined. It's you look at a game like A Hat in Time, for example, a game I've been banging on about the last
third person platformer.
Yeah, that was an attempt to make a game that was very much in the style of Mario Sunshine and Banjo-Kazooie, and it accomplished that and more, I would say. And it's no lesser in quality than either of those two games, but both of those were considered AAA games when they were released in 98 and even 2002 for Mario Sunshine. It doesn't look like AAA games of today. It doesn't have a 50-hour playtime. It doesn't have loot boxes. It doesn't have a big publisher's name. It doesn't have a 5,000 name credits list.
Half-hour credit sequence in Red Dead Redemption 2.
It's because people have been conditioned to think that AAA games are a certain thing, are 50-pound games that you can buy in a shop. You can have a AAA game that is disguised as an indie game.
But I mean, that's one of the things on the indie side is like something like the Unreal Engine 4 went free, so it was like developers had access to bigger budget tools.
I mean, in terms of quality,
but I mean, in terms of elevating the bar of what we think of when we think of an indie game, like there is still that assumption that it's going to be this like cheap like pixely type thing. But something like Hellblade like is ostensibly an indie game, except that it looks like a AAA game. And so like I think that one of the biggest questions is budgetary.
Look at it this way. A Hat in Time was Kickstarter funded, and I think it managed to raise something like $7 million.
Right.
Which is a significant fee. If you look at the very first Uncharted, had a budget of $20 million. And that's
like a fraction of something like Anthem or the assumptives of what Anthem would be going on.
I was
going
to say, there's recent Kickstarter games like Psychonauts 2, that's obviously building on something that's already had a big franchise. That only got $3.2 million.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
like
I think...
big money.
Yeah, I think so much money and like time and effort. I mean, I did a whole video on, is the industry heading for a crash kind of thing? Because it's like so much time and effort is put into fleshing out, like, making worlds look 4K or like so much extraneous detail that doesn't really matter. Like, detailing like some riverbed in the corner of an open world game that no one's ever going to get to. And that's my point about budgetary stuff.
Fluctuating equine.
Yeah, but it ties into what you said about is anyone really going to see all this stuff? Does it really matter?
It's
like,
completely superfluous to the experience. It's if.
Ooh.
I mean, I'm with you, but
a good game's a good game. You don't need all the bells and whistles.
That's what I was going to say. Just very quickly, because I had this whole tangent thing. Was because you said about people have been conditioned to expect these big like eye popping 4K over the top things, and that is because the industry always had like a half of like a tech focus. Like, look how much we've rendered this person's face. Look what we've done. Like, and that's the glass ceiling I think we're approaching.
I think it's interesting because I think as we approach the tech ceiling, it's now impossible, or it's becoming increasingly impossible for a developer to just release the same thing but better. It looks better, you can do more. Well, you can't do more. So where do you start making money? How do you reinvigorate people's interest in like tired franchises?
Remaster it and send it out again.
HD for a fifth time, but the answer is probably that you can't. So what you have to do is devise this perpetual model, which is what we've got now. We can continue to make money on a single product. And it's not necessarily what players want, but it is what unfortunately.
Is that what you were going to say before I cut you off?
Oh, I think I was just going to say it all boils back to the point of what you said about AAA, AAA games.
All the AAA.
Lovely batteries they are. About AAA games changing fundamentally of what we are expecting from them. Oh my God, my point's gone into the wind. It's the fundamental change of that is what's expecting. It is a technological expectation that's put on them, and it is everything in one that is expected from them. And there is a point where we're not going to be able to do that anymore. And I guess indie games are the sort of things where you have the side and it's going back in time. It's kind of like fashion, with films, we always get this nostalgic click where we go, oh, everything was actually better back then. Why don't we do that again?
Yeah, I did. One of the things that, again, like for me, the crux of the matter is budgetary and like the idea of risk taking. Like you read every time there's a big budget failure, Kotaku will do a big deep dive on exactly why it happened.
Yeah.
And a lot of the conversations with the big top tier publishers, especially the third party ones, they want to roll the dice on the biggest risks for the biggest payouts. And it's like when those things don't come back, like something like Anthem is obviously not disastrous, but it doesn't look very good. And like, you know, all the layoffs. Well,
but I would say that's not a big role on a big risk because it's something they've seen successful somewhere else and they've just tried to replicate it, which is why it's gone down the pan.
True. I guess I'm talking like risks in terms of like, I don't know, it's so safe.
I'd also be interested to know how commonly these apparent failures actually are failures in terms of gross profit and not net profit, because it's part of the issue is that the development teams and the budgets have become so dramatically unsustainable.
That's what I meant by risk, is the dev time.
Is that these are games that if they'd been released even 10 years previously would have been huge critical commercial successes, but it's not the case now.
No, but I think that, I mean, I'm going to plug my own stuff, but I happen to have an editorial coming up about the corporate poison
The
insulting poison of corporate gaming.
Jesus.
Because I think you can feel this stuff, and you can feel it in a lot of the big budget games. Like that's one of the things that puts you off a lot of AAA stuff,
stuff. You can feel that the games aren't designed.
Like in the same way they were across the 2000s and the 90s. That idea of mechanical innovation on the gameplay side. It's like, when was the last time we had a big AAA game that played fundamentally differently? Like, I mean, Battle Royale is a hell of a thing in terms of a genre, but like, when was the last time we had a nice new set of mechanics? Like, God of War, Spider-Man, they're so safe.
Well, totally right, because the first thing that put me off, personally, Red Dead Redemption 2, which I did play and really enjoyed afterwards, was that everyone was so obsessed with the light shining through people's cartilage, and I was I don't care. It is great. It's so interesting. It's amazing that we get to these levels with gameplay, and we can do all this with technological innovation, but the core of it should be solid narrative, which Red Dead Redemption 2
I was going to say gameplay.
Ooh.
I mean, I guess you got a bit of both.
I vote story every time.
Well, this is a new question.
Go on.
And unfortunately, it's one that's not served either way by AAA titles. Uh-huh. Because as I believe Amy Hennig said, these 40-hour, 50-hour, 100-hour, whatever, never-ending experiences, that's not conducive to an arc, a storyline arc that starts somewhere, reaches an apex and goes. It's something that has to go on constantly.
Well, so that quote, she was saying that, like something like games as a service or that approach, that idea of a business model, they're less conducive to traditional storytelling. Stories have a shape and an arc and a destination, but something that's a live service doesn't. And so like, that's the thing. I think there's a big problem with memorability. Mm. That something like Anthem, I forgot Anthem even happened the other day. Like it's been like a week.
Anthem so
I don't know,
much.
I don't.
How can you forget that hatred, honestly?
Well, that proves that I don't hate it because I kind of forgot. But I think that something like Anthem, it comes and everyone plays it for a bit and they're like, yep, cool, there's no memorable characters or particular like set piece moments or whatever. But if you go back like 10 years or like across the 2000s, you've got like Max Payne and Halo and Mass Effect and all these different worlds and laws and mythologies and characters that are memorable and talked about. Mm. It's like across the 2010s, it's like, when's the last time we had a new video game character or a world that everyone was talking about? Like, there's not that many, really, unless they're playing on an established world.
I think
that's the key point.
What I would say as well is that the idea of one character I can rally around, that dates back to The Mascot, which is something that, maybe not you, Ash, but certainly you, Scott.
Stone Age men,
We grew up with being...
The console mascot, that, the Crash
Bandicoot,
the Sonic.
Mascots and games revolving around characters, because that's how they were sold to us as children. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just the case that today's generation of gamers aren't as familiar with that and don't gravitate towards that as much. So it might not be as viable a model.
I think definitely the true in marketing, because I think gaming has become more mature. But I think we just don't have like those like developers. Sorry, publishers don't want to take the risk on a new establishing a whole new lore. I think Anthem should be praised in that regard. I actually quite like its world building.
The written stuff,
yes,
amazing. It's like the whole just to talk about Elder Scrolls Online, the way that they do their the YouTube shorts with the stories and everything behind them. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Well, it's like Overwatch, like all their lore is in YouTube shorts. Yeah. Like, there are, I mean, yes, okay, Overwatch fans, there is some stuff in the game, but it's not anywhere near as overt as in the shorts.
Exactly. That's where the heart of this game lies and what the interest and the pull is in the story, not so much the story, not so much the gameplay again. Because when you're actually playing the game, it's very dry and long and extended and drawn out and games of service, blah, blah, blah. Yep. But when you look at YouTube, then you're like, ooh, there's actually something interesting.
Well, as a point for that, I mean, Neil Blomkamp did a little short movie to go alongside the launch of Anthem. Mm. That short movie got me more interested in Anthem than anything that BioWare and EA have put out, because they focused on characters and arcs and the potential story and world and everything.
And
none of that's in the game.
It's so alien for BioWare as well, because it's what they're made and then
they're the story people.
Like. Yeah.
And it's almost like they themselves have been strong-armed in doing what everybody else has to
do. I'm looking forward to the deep dive, the Jason Schreier deep dive, and exactly what happened with that. Because his thing with Mass Effect Andromeda was fascinating, and you know, he's written about the end of Mass Effect 3 and things like that. So for someone like BioWare, they're almost like the perfect company to developer to hold up, because they've changed so much, like Baldur's Gate to Dragon Age and Mass Effect, all the way through to just a run-and-gun loot shooter. Mm. And I do think Anthem does have praiseworthy elements. I do think its world is enjoyable and stuff, but you can look at it and go like, yep, this is the base corporate approach to spreadsheet game design.
Look at Jade Empire. That's vastly underrated and mostly forgotten, and there's no connective tissue between Jade Empire and Anthem. You can hardly believe it's the same studio. Anthem could, if I didn't know, I would never guess it was a BioWare game.
Right.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
It's an EA game. Yeah, it's ostensibly an EA. Feels like EA it, game. Yeah.
But that's the thing. I mean, like something like Anthem, like, I mean, you have to do all these assumptions at the minute because it like I said, it feels like it has this corporate mentality to it. But I think bringing it back around to, we both before when you were like, oh, it's about story and I said it's about gameplay.
Yeah.
Something Hennig mentioned, which is really interesting, is that something like Uncharted 2 and 3 would gain multiplayer modes and so would sustain a fan base alongside you had the story. And I remember the Uncharted 2 and 3 for the story. I played very minimal of the multiplayer, but that seems to sustain people. And so it's like, you know,
like
do you need both?
3?
Yeah.
Like 3. I would say the multiplayer completely unnecessary to the actual integral story of that, no matter how good or bad
I didn't know Mass Effect 3 had multiple.
Exactly.
It's actually really solid though.
It's like, actually from working here that I found out it had. I was like, oh, I have to play the storyline.
Well, they try to tie it in because in Mass Effect 3 it was like you had the galactic readiness stat, which is going to play into your final end game, and they were like, hey, if you do a bunch of multiplayer missions that will help with your you know, story progress. Didn't do a whole lot, but at least they tried to sort of bring it together. But that's another question, is like, how much do you need like both sides of it? Because I remember when, I don't know if you guys played The Darkness back in like 2007 or 2008.
Ooh, no, I watched a film called that. But
it was a thing and a band, but but it was this whole thing. And I remember when The Darkness came out, and they just crowbarred a multiplayer mode into it, and it felt so tacked on.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling back then that it wasn't enough anymore to just have a story. You had to have something else.
I'll tell you a little story here.
Go on. Here he is.
I think you'd agree that, as we're saying with Darkness, the multiplayer in Uncharted 2 feels also tacked on. Like,
pretty much. It's actually pretty good.
Minute.
It's fine. Yeah. Like, yeah, but yeah.
But that was done to meet a necessity, to meet a requirement. Someone telling them, the publisher saying, put this on, people paying 50 quid for a game, but want to get more out of it, 8-hour storyline is not enough. Mm-hmm. When Rare were developing GoldenEye, this was back in 1995, so very, very close to the end of development, the team themselves thought, I wonder if we could have a multiplayer.
Yeah.
Can we do it? Like, And it was tacked on, but it was just because they wanted it in there, and it became one of the best on the N64.
But in that case, that's fascinating.
It is fascinating because it's just a completely different mentality. They were doing it because they wanted to. Mm. It was a thing of passion, whereas now it's because you have to.
Yeah.
It's a requirement.
But it's that Rare thing. It's like they operated on so much of their own level. I'm sure it was like the whole thing that Nintendo didn't even know it was
they
in
had
there.
Very, very, until it was on very, the disc. Yeah, there was very little interference from Nintendo, especially what with Nintendo of America communicating with Rare and Twycross at the time. So it was difficult to keep tabs. So they were pretty much just putting in as much as they could and doing as much as they could because they wanted to. And this is a team of about seven people, seven or eight people, you know, whereas Uncharted 2 had 150.
It was a fair whack,
team,
yeah.
I think,
The thing is with Uncharted, I mean, again, it's in the 2000s, so it's not as overblown as we have like today in terms of the budgets and the risks and all that kind of stuff. But Uncharted, I still feel like it has an authored sense to it. Like, you still feel like Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley's writing. Like, it has a, you know, a set of characters and all that kind of stuff.
It's got personality.
Yeah, personality.
Which is what games tend to lack. Mm-hmm. I used to, I mean, we know more about the development side of games now than we used to.
Mm-hmm.
For sure, we're certainly more about the process, but do we know about the personalities to develop the games as much? I don't think we do.
I think over the years, like things like, you know, you've got your people like Ken Levine, Hideo Kojima, like, you know, you have even the executives like Shuhei Yoshida, like people know names of figureheads, but I think like
There are certain, as you say, VR figureheads, there are certain, they're like totemic figures who can sometimes act as like flags for certain companies. But going back quite a while, people used to look forward to games from particular developers, like the developers themselves.
I think that's still the case for people like Naughty Dog. And I mean,
that's definitely the case for Amy Hennig.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, something like the personality side of it. I remember when looking, like growing up with Halo, like you would watch the new like Bungie like release docs and stuff, and it was like they were just like a team of nerds playing a great shooter, and they all played it themselves, and they balanced it amongst themselves, and there was a great feeling of like this indie sensibility, even though they weren't.
But
they were, you know, bigger.
That's what I think. What you're saying with Uncharted is you can sense it's been offered by Koenig and by actual people.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you get a game with like Anthem, Destiny, or any of the interchangeable Battle Royale shooters, there's no sense
that... Hey, Apex Legends is good.
Yeah, so. But I get no sense that one person sat back and thought, you know what my dream is? I want to create a loot box laden, never-ending shooter that looks all like all the rest of you.
Daddy, I want purple loot. Yeah. I'm sick of all this greed stuff. To bring something else in, which you mentioned before we came in, the idea that going forward, a lot of the industry is going to move into streaming and monthly services and just, you know, have like a big archive of titles that you download. How much do you guys think, just pure prediction side, that that will affect the way that games are doled out, that we'll get them in more episodically or, you know, they'll embrace the DLC and the additional story part that comes later and whatever?
I really hope not, because a DLC winds me up, which I know is a... I don't know if that's an unpopular opinion or not, actually.
No, I don't think so.
It just, I don't like having things tacked on afterwards, which is, again, the whole thing.
Or tacked off in advance.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just like, just give me the story. I'd rather pay more, have the whole complete thing, and I'd rather be able to play through it at my own leisure, enjoy everything. Mm-hmm. So I really hope that they don't do that. But looking at the industry as it is, and as talking about tacked on items as already with all these multiplayers and all these different things, DLC as it is all over the place and still coming out for really old releases now. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are going to get loads more of it because it's the way that the industry makes money, makes profits.
So. I think they're missing a huge trick, and I've thought this ever since like 2006 or whatever, since we started getting patches and the idea that a developer can add something to a game. Why don't they monetize older established stuff more? Because that's what Xbox and Microsoft have been proving with the Game Pass. It's like, hey, we've put the original Black Ops back on Game Pass, and then it goes back into the charts because people are buying it again. And so like, if you just go, we're going to do DLC for this a 6-7 year old game. Ugh. Like it doesn't I don't know, for me that sounds great because you can go back to like, here's another Mass Effect.
I don't know how
why? Practical it is, to be perfectly honest.
No, I don't know, like, well,
cost effective.
Maybe.
I mean, you're asking people to get their hands dirty with all tech.
Well, depends how far back you go, but I mean, I'm not saying make new original Mario levels, but like, I think there's something to be done with all those fan bases that just lie nascent, and then like we wait for the inevitable sequel.
Yeah.
The sequel disappoints because it follows new modern trends, and it's like, why don't you just plug stuff back into the old games, or like, you know,
you're right, but then you end up just having this whole, like, it doesn't turn into like a whole narrative. It turns into a narrative with loads of beads stuck on the end, and it's like just a flailing.
Well, not yet. It depends on the title, because I remember which Mass Effect had guy with the eye scar in the
costume.
It was Mass Effect 2. No. Doesn't matter. In Mass Effect 2, there were like two DLC characters. There was one dude.
Zaid.
Zaid and Kazumi.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking for them, because I thought Mass Effect 1 was so like solid. I think they did do DLC for Mass Effect 1, but it was like arena type stuff. It wasn't really anything integral.
I was like, yeah, outside.
Yeah. And so like when they did Mass Effect 2, I remember having that reaction of like, well, I don't need this. Mass Effect 2 will be this like straight thing. But I mean, I guess I'm talking more about levels and like reapproaching old game engines or like adding. I have to do it well. I don't think you can do it for everything. But I just think there's a way to monetize gaming as a legacy, as you know, over the years, and they haven't done that yet.
I guess what I should probably expand on is my main problem with DLC is when it integrates a story into a game that, like Zaid, for example, or like some of the Skyrim expansions and everything, where like it goes in and it's integral to a part of a story that you're already playing. Like it's already like, if you should be going around doing all these things and then discover,
and it's like change the thing that's ongoing,
or like all that sort of thing. Whereas if it was DLC, it should be something like The Last of Us, Staying Alive or whatever it's called.
BG Boogaloo.
Not
it's
dead.
Called Lost Legacy.
That, I don't know, whatever it's called.
Yes.
That was like an add-on little chapter where you could have completed the game and come back to it like a year later or whatever, playing.
Well, they made it a standalone thing, but it did start as DLC.
It should be
additional.
That, yeah,
right.
It
nothing
should be,
more. An appendix, if you want. It's like, I totally agree. I can't cope playing something knowing that I have to pay money to get a full experience, having already bought it, or that something, or that what I'm playing isn't the complete version, or it could be changed at a later date. I think, what's the point in getting invested in something that's going to be altered?
Well, that's, I mean, that's a different conversation for a different pod. In terms of, I think a lot of publishers treat the consumer base as beta testers, whether that's because, like, you know, the second installment is everything the first was meant to be, or something releases in just such a fractured, broken form.
Well, back to your original point about a streaming service, I actually think we'll get a service similar to something like Netflix, an over-the-top service where...
That's like what Microsoft's trying to do.
Yeah, where the publishers... directly selling you the game, that you pay a subscription fee to the publisher, and that gives you access to all their titles over the course of, you know, the year. You pay per month, and they'll release it in piecemeal components, not necessarily episodic when we build as such, because then it makes it sound like you're getting a small thing. They'll say, like, I don't know, for an example, here's Anthem, but you only get like
well,
a chunk of the content, and they'll gradually add to it, and like you keep paying, you get more. Mm-hmm. So it's like basically as World of Warcraft's been working, or MMOs have been working for the last.
That's a good test case, because obviously, like, yeah, Warcraft, but that's obviously so big that you can't just plug additional campaigns and characters and stuff into it.
And the big difference with MMOs is that the social, there's something else to keep you playing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In Anthem's case, though, like to bring it, like you can kind of connect it all together, because Anthem obviously charges up front, premium price or whatever. Yeah. Then immediately on day one, they were like, here's our roadmap for the rest of the year. And there's a big old story chunk of Anthem not coming, I think it's in May, which is like deals with something that happens after the end. And so it's like, okay, like I quite like the idea of gaming playing with itself as a medium and being like, well, we're going to give you like episode one or the first massive chunk and we'll add to this as we go and you're with us for the long haul kind of thing. And you've already bought into the whole thing.
Like I think Shenmue, it's like we're 20 years and you can have that.
yeah, they're finally wrapping that up. But
if
I think,
you say know, that, sorry, if they just sorry. Say that from the outset, that's fine. If they say this is like Walking Dead seasons, yes. Telltale Games, if they say it is fine.
And also the other major thing is the price. You're not paying £50 for episode one of The Walking Dead.
Well, that's what would go away if you did the monthly thing.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Well, as long as the price points of AAA games are like 55, 60 quid, and I know that hasn't actually changed, but what you're getting has changed.
If anything, it's gone down, like based on some generations.
Well, it depends. I know when the N64 first came out, you're paying 60, 70 quid for some cards, but that was because of production and rarity. It wasn't because it was just standard, but...
Right.
Yeah, about 50 quid, isn't it? About 55 quid.
Mm-hmm. I just remember some headline being like, we're paying less for games these days than we ever have.
Well,
it's like, kinda.
We might be, but we're not getting as much for the money. So, but you have to get there's a certain level that you have to get for that money, which you could eliminate completely with a streaming service. Mm-hmm. If you're paying £10 a month, you're quite satisfied that you're getting a half-finished game, because that's only a tenner.
Or I really don't want it to get that way. The thing that it's like is exactly like the film industry and the TV industry and what's happening now with Netflix as a streaming service, which we've already brought up, is that people are gravitating towards TV and they want like weekly installments and things that keep going so they can stay in these worlds. But then
I think the movie industry is going to become increasingly episodic.
Bad. Which I would hate. But like,
We're already seeing it happen, like you say, like. Movies being converted into TV series on Netflix.
Kind of. And you get part one, part two, but that is dying off a bit again, because I think film is coming back to its natural form of being like, right, well, here is a film, here is the story. If we're going to do another one, it will be a sequel, which is its own contained story.
They tried with like Ultimate Editions and XYZ, and it was like,
But it's like... Well, where we've gone with Netflix is having all these episodic things, and people want to binge them is the thing. People want 10 episodes released at the same time. They want an extended long-form story that they can have in chunks, but at their own leisure, which I think is what gaming will do. I think it will go through this thing of being more episodic, more bits and bits and bits, until people go, just give me all my crumbs, I want a loaf of bread, and like make it into one big release, which is what this streaming service could do. It could release the crumb one by one and then have them all collected at the end until people go, right, just give us the
goddamn game.
That might sound like a decent thing in some regards, but that means
instead of... you need a loaf of bread to feed your family.
Exactly.
What if you were told you need to pay three times the price for that loaf of bread to feed your family?
That brings us full circle, because then you've got the corporate mentalities infecting that idea again.
If you get a game that they say, well, you're paying a yearly subscription, you're going to get a chunk of it every month. Mm-hmm. After 12 months, you might have paid £120 for this one game.
I mean, that's the thing with gaming, is that all these things are constantly in flux. I mean, how you monetize a monthly rollout of... I mean, at the minute, we've got Game Pass and we've got PlayStation Now, and that's pretty much it.
But they work so well because they release fat chunks of games together as one thing.
Game Pass is tremendous value, because you get a lot of free games on it.
Yeah.
Legacy games. You get actual complete games.
The thing. They're not games when they're chunks. They're like playable experiences. It's not a game.
It's like having a library card. You go in, you expect to be able to take out a full book. I know libraries do still exist.
Brilliant contemporary reference there. Yeah. some stuff, though, I mean, we will wrap the podcast up, but some stuff like Game Pass, they'll do like, here's episode one of Life is Strange, or here's episode one of some other thing that is going to be episodic from the outset. Mm. And so I guess like it's a communication issue in that regard, because you wouldn't just play something and then realize it's not all there. But I do think having the monthly thing would relax all those expectations, because a lot of the problems that people have with games is that they've invested this premium price thing, and a premium, you know, like AAA game just isn't what it used to be in terms of the state it is at launch and how much is going to be added over time. Ooh. So there's
the other way it could go. I'm just going to throw in another fish into the frying pan. I've got food on the mind.
The loaves and the fish,
fish and bread, the two quantities we need. But to have another thought, I think another way the game industry could go would be to look at Kickstarter, and that being used as something that we are invested in as episodic, but they only release the full game at the end of this narrative of this is what we're doing now, this is what we're doing now. We'd like your opinion on this. Here's a beta test.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about like a sort of democratized model of video games.
So well, that could be what you pay to invest in. You watch the experience happen and have your say in it.
So in a sense, the consumers become the developers.
Well, that's literally what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying in terms of we've been forced into being. That's that relationship between a developer and a consumer base is what we have right now, but we're unwillingly part of that.
Yeah.
Because everyone sends all the feedback back and then they implement, here's a bunch of day one patches or patches going forward, features that were missed or whatever. And it's that relationship, but without it being advertised as Kickstarter. So it's a communication issue as well. But for now, we're going to wrap this thing. We might do a part two, depending on how many other thoughts and conversations and rambles we have as we leave this room. But for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. Let me know what you think down in the comments below if you're watching the video version, or you can find us on social media if you're on any of the audio platforms. So yes, I've been your host, Scott Taylor, joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Goodbye. Nice to be here.
Joined by Ash Millman.
Goodbye.
I'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.